You can help them to curse me and denounce me. You can all stay home, take no risks, and make no enemies. Just keep out of my way.
Well, he said slowly, of course the problems involved in the policy of a great railroad system are complex. While a small independent company in the name of one person could afford to...
Yes, Jim, yes, I know all that. The moment you announce that you're turning the Rio Norte line over to me, the Taggart stock will rise. The bedbugs will stop crawling from out of unlikely corners, since they won't have the incentive of a big company to bite. Before they decide what to do about me, I will have the line finished. And as for me, I don't want to have you and your board to account to argue with, to beg permissions from. There isn't any time for that, if I'm to do the kind of job that has to be done. So I'm going to do it alone.
And if you fail?
If I fail, I'll go down alone. You understand that in such case Taggart Transcontinental will not be able to help you in any way?
I understand. You will not count on us?
No.
You will cut all official connection with us, so that your activities will not reflect upon our reputation?
Yes.
I think we should agree that in case of failure or public scandal, your leave of absence will become permanent. That is, you will not expect to return to the post of vice president.
She closed her eyes for a moment. All right, Jim. In such case, I will not return.
Before we transfer the Rio Norte line to you, we must have a written agreement that you will transfer it back to us, along with your controlling interest, at cost, in case the line becomes successful. Otherwise, you might try to squeeze us for a windfall profit, since we need that line.
There was only a brief stab of shock in her eyes. Then she said indifferently, the words sounding as if she were tossing alms, "By all means, Jim. Have that stated in writing."
"Now, as to your temporary successor..."
"Yes?"
"You don't really want it to be Eddie Willers, do you?"
"Yes, I do."
"But he couldn't even act like a vice president. He doesn't have the presence, the manner, the..."
"He knows his work, and mine. He knows what I want. I trust him. I'll be able to work with him."
"Don't you think it would be better to pick one of our more distinguished young men? Somebody from a good family with more social poise, and..."
"It's going to be Eddie Willers, Jim." He sighed.
"All right. Only we must be careful about it. We don't want people to suspect that it's you who are still running Taggart Transcontinental. Nobody must know it."
"Everybody will know it, Jim. But since nobody will admit it openly, everybody will be satisfied."
"But we must preserve appearances."
"Oh, certainly. You don't have to recognize me on the street if you don't want to. You can say you've never seen me before, and I'll say I've never heard of Taggart Transcontinental." He remained silent, trying to think, staring down at the floor. She turned to look at the grounds beyond the window. The sky had the even gray-white pallor of winter. Far below, on the shore of the Hudson, she saw the road she used to watch for Francisco's car. She saw the cliff over the river where they climbed to look for the towers of New York. And somewhere beyond the woods were the trails that led to Rockdale Station. The earth was snow-covered now, and what remained was like the skeleton of the countryside she remembered, a thin design of bare branches rising from the snow to the sky. It was gray and white, like a photograph. A dead photograph, which one keeps hopefully for remembrance, but which has no power to bring back anything.
"What are you going to call it?"
She turned, startled.
"What?" "What are you going to call your company?"
"Oh, why, the Dagny Taggart line, I guess.
But do you think that's wise? It might be misunderstood. The Taggart might be taken as..."
"Well, what do you want me to call it?" she snapped, worn down to anger. "The Miss Nobody? The Madam X? The John Galt?" She stopped. She smiled suddenly. A cold, bright, dangerous smile. "That's what I'm going to call it. The John Galt line."
"Good God, no!"
"Yes."
"But it's just a cheap piece of slang."
"Yes."
"You can't make a joke out of such a serious project. You can't be so vulgar and undignified."
"Can't I?"
"But for God's sake, why?"
"Because it's going to shock all the rest of them, just as it shocked you."
"I've never seen you playing for effects."
"I am this time."
"But..." His voice dropped to an almost superstitious sound.
Look, Dagny, you know, it's bad luck. What it stands for is...
He stopped. What does it stand for?
I don't know, but the way people use it, they always seem to say it out of
fear, despair, futility.
Yes. Yes, that's what it is.
That's what I want to throw in their faces. The bright, sparkling anger in her eyes, her first look of enjoyment, made him understand that he had to keep still.
Draw up all the papers and all the red tape in the name of the John Galt line, she said.
He sighed.
Well, it's your line.
You bet it is. He glanced at her, astonished. She had dropped the manners and style of a vice president. She seemed to be relaxing happily to the level of yard crews and construction gangs.
As to the papers and the legal side of it, he said, there might be some difficulties. We would have to apply for the permission of...
She whirled to face him. Something of the bright, violent look still remained in her face, but it was not gay, and she was not smiling. The look now had an odd, primitive quality. When he saw it, he hoped he would never have to see it again.
Listen, Jim, she said. He had never heard that tone in any human voice.
There is one thing you can do as your part of the deal, and you'd better do it. Keep your Washington boys off. See to it that they give me all the permissions, authorizations, charters, and other waste paper that their laws require. Don't let them try to stop me. If they try...
Jim, people say that our ancestor Nat Taggart killed a politician who tried to refuse him a permission he should never have had to ask.
I don't know whether Nat Taggart did it or not, but I'll tell you this. I know how he felt if he did. If he didn't, I might do the job for him, to complete the family legend.
I mean it, Jim.
Francisco D'Anconia sat in front of her desk. His face was blank. It had remained blank while Dagny explained to him, in the clear, impersonal tone of a business interview, the formation and purpose of her own railroad company. He had listened. He had not pronounced a word. She had never seen his face wear that look of drained passivity. There was no mockery, no amusement, no antagonism. It was as if he did not belong in these particular moments of existence and could not be reached. Yet his eyes looked at her attentively. They seemed to see more than she could suspect. They made her think of one-way glass. They let all light rays in, but none out.
Francisco, I asked you to come here because I wanted you to see me in my office. You've never seen it. It would have meant something to you once.
His eyes moved slowly to look at the office. Its walls were bare except for three things. A map of Taggart Transcontinental, the original drawing of Nat Taggart that had served as model for his statue, and a large railroad calendar in cheerfully crude colors, the kind that was distributed each year with a change of its picture to every station along the Taggart track, the kind that had hung once in her first workplace at Rockdale. He got up. He said quietly, "Dagny, for your own sake," and it was a barely perceptible hesitation, "and in the name of any pity you might feel for me, don't request what you're going to request. Don't. Let me go now." This was not like him, and like nothing she could ever have expected to hear from him. After a moment she asked, "Why?"
"I can't answer you. I can't answer any questions. That is one of the reasons why it's best not to discuss it."
"You know what I'm going to request?"
"Yes."
The way she looked at him was such an eloquent, desperate question that he had to add, "I know that I'm going to refuse."
"Why?"
He smiled mirthlessly, spreading his hands out as if to show her that this was what he had predicted and had wanted to avoid. She said quietly,
"I have to try, Francisco. I have to make the request. That's my part. What you'll do about it is yours. But I'll know that I've tried everything."
He remained standing, but he inclined his head a little in assent and said, "I will listen, if that will help you." "I need $15 million to complete the Rio Norte line. I have obtained $7 million against the Taggart stock I own, free and clear. I can raise nothing else. I will issue bonds in the name of my new company in the amount of $8 million. I called you here to ask you to buy these bonds. He did not answer. I am simply a beggar, Francisco, and I am begging you for money. I had always thought that one did not beg in business. I thought that one stood on the merit of what one had to offer and gave value for value. This is not so anymore, though I don't understand how we can act on any other rule and continue to exist. Judging by every objective fact, the Rio Norte line is to be the best railroad in the country. Judging by every known standard, it is the best investment possible. And that is what damns me. I cannot raise money by offering people a good business venture. The fact that it's good makes people reject it. There is no bank that would buy the bonds of my company. So I can't plead merit. I can only plead. Her voice was pronouncing the words with impersonal precision. She stopped, waiting for his answer. He remained silent. I know that I have nothing to offer you, she said. I can't speak to you in terms of investment. You don't care to make money. Industrial projects have ceased to concern you long ago. So I won't pretend that it's a fair exchange. It's just begging. She drew her breath and said, Give me that money as alms, because it means nothing to you. Don't, he said, his voice low. She could not tell whether the strange sound of it was pain or anger. His eyes were lowered. Will you do it, Francisco? No. After a moment, she said, I called you not because I thought you would agree, but because you were the only one who could understand what I'm saying. So I had to try it. Her voice was dropping lower, as if she hoped it would make emotion harder to detect. You see, I can't believe that you're really gone, because I know that you're still able to hear me. The way you live is depraved, but the way you act is not. Even the way you speak of it is not. I had to try. But I can't struggle to understand you any longer. I'll give you a hint. Contradictions do not exist. Whenever you think that you are facing a contradiction, check your premises. You will find that one of them is wrong. Francisco, she whispered, why don't you tell me what it was that happened to you? Because at this moment the answer would hurt you more than the doubt. Is it as terrible as that? It is an answer which you must reach by yourself. She shook her head. I don't know what to offer you. I don't know what is of value to you any longer. Don't you see that even a beggar has to give value in return, has to offer some reason why you might want to help him? Well, I thought. At one time it meant a great deal to you, success, industrial success. Remember how we used to talk about it? You were very severe. You expected a lot from me. You told me I'd better live up to it. I have. You wondered how far I'd rise with Taggart Transcontinental. She moved her hand, pointing at the office. This is how far I've risen. So I thought, if the memory of what had been your values still has some meaning for you, if only as amusement or a moment's sadness, or just like putting flowers on a grave, you might want to give me the money. In the name of that, he added in explanation. He wasn't prepared to proceed at once either. It's 8,000 tons of Reardon metal, structural metal for coal mines. They glanced at each other and smiled. They needed no further comment. He glanced down as she handed the telegrams back to him. The skin of her hand looked transparent in the light on the edge of his desk. A young girl's hand with long, thin fingers, relaxed for a moment, defenseless. The Stockton Foundry in Colorado, she said, is going to finish that order for me, the one that the Amalgamated Switch and Signal Company ran out on. They're going to get in touch with you about the metal. They have already. What have you done about the construction crews? Neely's engineers are staying on, the best ones, those I need, and most of the foremen, too. It won't be too hard to keep them going. Neely wasn't of much use anyway. What about labor? More applicants than I can hire. I don't think the union is going to interfere. Most of the applicants are giving phony names. They're union members. They need the work desperately. I'll have a few guards on the line, but I don't expect any trouble. What about your brother Jim's board of directors? They're all scrambling to get statements into the newspapers,
to the effect that they have no connection whatever with the John Galt line, and how reprehensible an undertaking they think it is. They agreed to everything I asked. The line of her shoulders looked taut, yet thrown back easily, as if poised for flight. Tension seemed natural to her, not a sign of anxiety, but a sign of enjoyment. The tension of her whole body under the gray suit, half visible in the darkness. "Eddie Willers has taken over the office of operating vice president," she said. "If you need anything, get in touch with him. I'm leaving for Colorado tonight."
"Tonight?"
"Yes, we have to make up time. We've lost a week."
"Flying your own plane?"
"Yes. I'll be back in about 10 days. I intend to be in New York once or twice a month."
"Where will you live out there?"
"On the site, in my own railway car. That is, Eddie's car, which I'm borrowing."
"Will you be safe?"
"Safe from what?" Then she laughed, startled. "Why, Hank, it's the first time you've ever thought that I wasn't a man. Of course I'll be safe." He was not looking at her. He was looking at a sheet of figures on his desk. "I've had my engineers prepare a breakdown of the cost of the bridge," he said, "and an approximate schedule of the construction time required. That is what I wanted to discuss with you." He extended the papers. She settled back to read them. A wedge of light fell across her face. He saw the firm, sensual mouth in sharp outline. Then she leaned back a little, and he saw only a suggestion of its shape and the dark lines of her lowered lashes. "Haven't I?" he thought. "Haven't I thought of it since the first time I saw you? Haven't I thought of nothing else for 2 years?" He sat motionless, looking at her. He heard the words he had never allowed himself to form, the words he had felt, known, yet had not faced, had hoped to destroy by never letting them be said within his own mind. Now it was as sudden and shocking as if he were saying it to her. "Since the first time I saw you, nothing but your body, that mouth of yours, and the way your eyes would look at me, if, through every sentence I ever said to you, through every conference you thought so safe, through the importance of all the issues we discussed, you trusted me, didn't you? To recognize your greatness, to think of you as you deserved, as if you were a man. Don't you suppose I know how much I've betrayed? The only bright encounter of my life, the only person I respected, the best businessman I know, my ally, my partner in a desperate battle, the lowest of all desires, as my answer to the highest I've met. Do you know what I am? I thought of it because it should have been unthinkable. For that degrading need which should never touch you, I have never wanted anyone but you. I hadn't known what it was like to want it until I saw you for the first time. I had thought, not I. I couldn't be broken by it. Since then, for 2 years, with not a moment's respite, do you know what it's like to want it? Would you wish to hear what I thought when I looked at you? When I lay awake at night? When I heard your voice over a telephone wire? When I worked, but could not drive it away? To bring you down to things you can't conceive? And to know that it's I who have done it, to reduce you to a body, to teach you an animal's pleasure, to see you need it, to see you asking me for it, to see your wonderful spirit dependent upon the obscenity of your need, to watch you as you are, as you face the world with your clean, proud strength, then to see you in my bed submitting to any infamous whim I may devise, to any act which I'll perform for the sole purpose of watching your dishonor, and to which you'll submit for the sake of an unspeakable sensation. I want you, and may I be damned for it." She was reading the papers, leaning back in the darkness. He saw the reflection of the fire touching her hair, moving to her shoulder, down her arm, to the naked skin of her wrist. "Do you know what I'm thinking now in this moment? Your gray suit and your open collar? You look so young, so austere, so sure of yourself. What would you be like if I knocked your head back, if I threw you down in that formal suit of yours, if I raised your skirt?" She glanced up at him. He looked down at the papers on his desk. In a moment, he said, "The actual cost of the bridge is less than our original estimate. You will note that the strength of the bridge allows for the eventual addition of a second track, which I think that section of the country will justify in a very few years.
If you spread the cost over a period of... He spoke, and she looked at his face in the lamplight against the black emptiness of the office. The lamp was outside her field of vision, and she felt as if it were his face that illuminated the papers on the desk. His face, she thought, and the cold, radiant clarity of his voice, of his mind, of his drive to a single purpose. The face was like his words, as if the line of a single theme ran from the steady glance of the eyes through the gaunt muscles of the cheeks to the faintly scornful downward curve of the mouth. The line of a ruthless asceticism. The day began with the news of a disaster. A freight train of the Atlantic Southern had crashed head-on into a passenger train in New Mexico on a sharp curve in the mountains, scattering freight cars all over the slopes. The cars carried 5,000 tons of copper, bound from a mine in Arizona, to the Reardon Mills. Reardon telephoned the general manager of the Atlantic Southern, but the answer he received was, "Oh, God, Mr. Reardon, how can we tell? How can anybody tell how long it will take to clear that wreck? One of the worst we've ever had." "I don't know, Mr. Reardon. There are no other lines anywhere in that section. The track is torn for 1,200 feet. There's been a rock slide. Our wrecking train can't get through. I don't know how we'll ever get those freight cars back on rails, or when. Can't expect it sooner than 2 weeks."
"3 days? Impossible, Mr. Reardon."
"But we can't help it."
"But surely you can tell your customers that it's an act of God. What if you do hold them up? Nobody can blame you in a case of this kind."
In the next 2 hours, with the assistance of his secretary, two young engineers from his shipping department, a road map, and the long-distance telephone, Reardon arranged for a fleet of trucks to proceed to the scene of the wreck, and for a chain of hopper cars to meet them at the nearest station of the Atlantic Southern. The hopper cars had been borrowed from Taggart Transcontinental. The trucks had been recruited from all over New Mexico, Arizona, and Colorado. Reardon's engineers had hunted by telephone for private truck owners, and had offered payments that cut all arguments short. It was the third of 3 shipments of copper that Reardon had expected. 2 orders had not been delivered. 1 company had gone out of business. The other was still pleading delays that it could not help. He had attended to the matter without breaking his chain of appointments, without raising his voice, without sign of strain, uncertainty, or apprehension. He had acted with the swift precision of a military commander under sudden fire. And Gwen Ives, his secretary, had acted as his calmest lieutenant. She was a girl in her late 20s, whose quietly harmonious, impenetrable face had a quality matching the best-designed office equipment. She was one of his most ruthlessly competent employees. Her manner of performing her duties suggested the kind of rational cleanliness that would consider any element of emotion while at work as an unpardonable immorality. When the emergency was over, her sole comment was, "Mr. Reardon, I think we should ask all our suppliers to ship via Taggart Transcontinental."
"I'm thinking that, too," he answered.
Then added, "Wire Fleming in Colorado. Tell him I'm taking an option on that copper mine property." He was back at his desk, speaking to his superintendent on one phone, and to his purchasing manager on another, checking every date and ton of ore on hand. He could not leave to chance or to another person the possibility of a single hour's delay in the flow of a furnace. It was the last of the rail for the John Galt line that was being poured. When the buzzer rang and Miss Ives' voice announced that his mother was outside, demanding to see him. He had asked his family never to come to the mills without appointment. He had been glad that they hated the place and seldom appeared in his office. What he now felt was a violent impulse to order his mother off the premises. Instead, with a greater effort than the problem of the train wreck had required of him, he said quietly, "All right. Ask her to come in." His mother came in with an air of belligerent defensiveness. She looked at his office as if she knew what it meant to him, and as if she were declaring her resentment against anything being of greater importance to him than her own person. She took a long time settling down in an armchair, arranging and rearranging her bag, her gloves, the folds of her dress, while droning, "It's a fine thing when a mother has to wait in an anteroom and ask permission of a stenographer before she's allowed to see her own son, who..."
"Mother, is it anything important? I am very rushed today."
"You're not the only one who's got problems. Of course it's important.
Do you think I'd go to the trouble of driving way out here if it wasn't important?
What is it?
It's about Philip.
Yes?
Philip is unhappy.
Well?
He feels it's not right that he should have to depend on your charity and live on handouts and never be able to count on a single dollar of his own.
Well, he said with a startled smile, I've been waiting for him to realize that.
It isn't right for a sensitive man to be in such a position.
It certainly isn't.
I'm glad you agree with me. So what you have to do is give him a job.
What?
You must give him a job here at the mills, but a nice, clean job, of course, with a desk and an office and a decent salary, where he wouldn't have to be among your day laborers and your smelly furnaces.
He knew that he was hearing it. He could not make himself believe it.
Mother, you're not serious. I certainly am. I happen to know that that's what he wants, only he's too proud to ask you for it. But if you offer it to him, and make it look like it's you who are asking him a favor, why, I know he'd be happy to take it. That's why I had to come up here to talk to you, so he wouldn't guess that I put you up to it.
It was not in the nature of his consciousness to understand the nature of the things he was hearing. A single thought cut through his mind like a spotlight, making him unable to conceive how any eyes could miss it. The thought broke out of him as a cry of bewilderment.
But he knows nothing about the steel business. What has that got to do with it? He needs a job,
but he couldn't do the work.
He needs to gain self-confidence and to feel important.
But he wouldn't be any good whatever.
He needs to feel that he's wanted.
Here? What could I want him for?
You hire plenty of strangers.
I hire men who produce.
What has he got to offer?
He's your brother, isn't he?
What has that got to do with it?
She stared incredulously in turn, silenced by shock. For a moment they sat looking at each other, as if across an interplanetary distance.
He's your brother, she said, her voice like a phonograph record repeating a magic formula she could not permit herself to doubt. He needs a position in the world. He needs a salary so that he'd feel that he's got money coming to him as his due, not his alms.
As his due? But he wouldn't be worth a nickel to me.
Is that what you think of first? Your profit? I'm asking you to help your brother, and you're figuring how to make a nickel on him, and you won't help him unless there's money in it for you, is that it?
She saw the expression of his eyes, and she looked away, but spoke hastily, her voice rising.
Yes, sure, you're helping him. Like you'd help any stray beggar. Material help, that's all you know or understand. Have you thought about his spiritual needs, and what his position is doing to his self-respect? He doesn't want to live like a beggar. He wants to be independent of you.
By means of getting from me a salary he can't earn for work he can't do.
You'd never miss it. You've got enough people here who are making money for you.
Are you asking me to help him stage a fraud of that kind?
You don't have to put it that way.
Is it a fraud, or isn't it?
That's why I can't talk to you, because you're not human. You have no pity. No feeling for your brother, no compassion for his feelings.
Is it a fraud or not?
You have no mercy for anybody.
Do you think that a fraud of this kind would be just?
You're the most immoral man living. You think of nothing but justice. You don't feel any love at all.
He got up, his movement, abrupt and stressed. The movement of ending an interview and ordering a visitor out of his office. Mother, I'm running a steel plant, not a whorehouse.
Henry!
The gasp of indignation was at his choice of language, nothing more. Don't ever speak to me again about a job for Philip. I would not give him the job of a cinder sweeper. I would not allow him inside my mills. I want you to understand that once and for all. You may try to help him in any way you wish, but don't ever let me see you thinking of my mills as a means to that end. The wrinkles of her soft chin trickled into a shape resembling a sneer.
What are they, your mills? A holy temple of some kind?
Why, yes,